Thanks very much, everyone, for coming. Apologies for the slight late running of this. I'll leave the door open for a minute. We're being overly paranoid with the recording equipment since the recording we attempted to make of last week's seminar died, and we don't therefore have anything to podcast. So I'll give the minimum of introduction. I'll just say very briefly that we have going around, most of you probably can see at least, there are flyers which have the timetable for the rest of this seminar. This is the second seminar in a series of 12, I believe. And there are also posters for next week's seminar, in which Scott Porter, also from the University of Kentucky, is going to talk to us about the Son of Suda Online, which is a next-generation collaborative editing tool, primarily for papyrological texts, hence the image on the poster. But also potentially for working with epigraphical and various other kinds of texts, including literary and anything else, with modifications. So that will no doubt be an excellent seminar. This week, we're extremely pleased to be able to welcome Professor Brent Seals, who's the director of the Center for Visualization and Virtual Environments at the University of Kentucky. And he's going to present some work he's been doing over the last few years on a project called EDUCE, Enhanced Digital Unwrapping for Conservation and Exploration. And you've been working especially with classroom materials recently, and he's going to tell us a bit about that work here now.
So thank you for the introduction. It's my pleasure to be here. I'd like to give special thanks to my team for not getting distracted with Central London and actually coming to hear me get a yada talk. I wanted them all to come so that they could meet you, mainly, because they've heard me talk at length forever. So my co-PI, Jim Griffune, is here, and members of our technical team, Matt, Ryan, Tim, and Steve. So the project I'm going to talk about today is EDUCE. It has some breadth to it, so I'm going to start by focusing in on something that we did last year and are just producing the results, and then I'll broaden near the end of the talk, see if we can respect the time so that we'll have plenty of time for questions. And if we make this informal and you see something you'd like to ask me about, I think we can just interrupt me and we'll talk about it. The project that I'll begin with was hatched more than 5 years ago, not by me, but by the Center for Hellenic Studies and a very large team of scholars. This shot of Venice kind of captures for me the breadth of what had to happen to make that project come to fruition. My part was a small piece, a technical piece, and you'll see by the end of the talk how it relates to the things that are overall I'm interested in. One thing I'm interested in is exotic travel. So when you work with classical materials and other kinds of cultural heritage objects, you usually get out of Lexington, Kentucky, or Dayton, Ohio. So you know, that's good for me. And this project took place in Venice, specifically at the Marciano Library, which housed the Venetus A. And that manuscript, one of, I think, the oldest extant full copy of Homer's Iliad, complete copy. And there are other copies, obviously. This manuscript hadn't been made into a facsimile for 100 years. The Comparetti photographic facsimile had been made in 1901, and that was the last time it had been photographed or digitized. So the objective was to take that manuscript and do some digitization, and as a latecomer into the team that spent all the time making the connections necessary to make that happen, I was able to bring some fairly recent technology that my team had developed to the mix, and we were able to get some results. So I want to start by talking with you about that and about the challenges of working in Venice. We were driven to distraction with the beauty of the place, really, and also with the challenge of just getting around. I'll show you a quick little beauty shot here from my photographer and videographer Steve Bailey, and this is the Marciano Library on Plaza San Marco. And let's hope that this will synchronize okay. The screen mode. There we go. Okay, so a nice shot. Marciana on the left-hand side. Everywhere you look, incredibly beautiful. Project was done in the month of May to try to minimize the impact on the object because there isn't really good climate control in the Marciana at large. So we had to suffer early May in Venice, okay? So hopefully when I show you some of the results and explain to you what we did, you'll appreciate that we got any work done at all because it was such a beautiful place to be. I really can't say enough about how fun it was to be involved with that project, but so many ways I could tell this narrative. I think that I should probably focus on text. So this is what the text looks like. And you can see, we knew from the condition report that the conservators had done that the pages of the text, vellum, or parchment, were quite cockled. This is a Byzantine copy of a Homeric piece. And you can see the cockling, the waving, when you look at this edge-on view. So one of the things I was concerned about from a technical point of view, and as a computer scientist, I've been interested in long-term issues of how you actually capture a facsimile when photography basically compresses all the information about waviness and depth. Maybe there might be a better way to make a representation than just doing straight up photography. So we knew this would be the case. And so when we got to the biblioteca and got set up, the goal in the place where we were going to do the work, and this is a view from the near the room where we did the work into the reading room of the Marciana Library. The goal was to try to get as accurate a facsimile of this manuscript as possible, including the fact that the pages would not be flat. So I want to talk to you a little bit about the technology that we used. You all know the story, and I'm not a classicist, so Homer's Iliad is a very rich and involved set of stories and actors and characters. I'm more familiar, of course, with the movie version. And some of you may actually, in your mind, imagine other people you know being part of that story. I don't know. In terms of the cast of characters that we brought to the table, I have to acknowledge the people who were involved because they really drove the project forward. Some of these people, I'm sure you know, the classicists involved, driven primarily by Chris Blackwell and Casey Duhaeke, and conservators involved, computer scientists, and you may know Manfred Meyer, who is also a conservator and the inventor of this cradle that we were able to use to actually do the digitization. And I have a picture here of Matt Field. Really, there was a team of 20 people, so you can imagine the logistics of getting everybody to Venice, making us all not be distracted by the beauty, getting us into the Marciana, and then making this happen. So really what I want to talk about is how this text looked and what we had to do to get the digital copy that we got and then what we can do with it now that we've got it digitized. As you open up the text, what you end up seeing in the facsimiles, and on this projector we're going to lose a little bit of the color, but this is a color image. You end up seeing that the primary text has marginalia scolia, interlinear comments everywhere, and the 1901 facsimile simply was not able to capture in high enough resolution all of the detail of that. It was a black and white facsimile, was not color. So the five of those copies that were broadly circulated were the copies used for scholarship. Primary object at the Marciana was very restricted in terms of its use. Conservators didn't give many people access, and that was the condition that it remained in. So I'm going to frame this story by telling you first about the technology that we used and what we discovered when we did the digitization, and then what I consider to be the Holy Grail, and that's where I'll broaden the talk at the end, and we'll look at a bigger vision of what I see happening in the marriage between the classics and technology. So let's first start with technology. The basis for our digitization was this cradle, Manfred's cradle, because we were able to support the manuscript binding very carefully and position everything very precisely using this engineered set of axes that would align the camera and the page that you're trying to digitize so that you have this nice orthogonality constraint. That is, the the direction of the camera is exactly orthonormal to the position of the page. Now, when you get that in Euclidean idealized terms, it's possible to have a flat plane and a line orthogonal to that plane, but when you have a page that looks like this, nothing's ever really orthonormal. And so that's where this robot comes in, which was one of our contributions. When these pages get pulled ready to, and are held by the cradle ready to be digitized, you can see that there are still places that the manuscript will wave. We used the robot as a way to capture the exact 3D shape to a very high degree of resolution. So by mating that 3D shape with the high resolution photography, we were able to capture a very accurate facsimile of the shape and the appearance of every page. So it was kind of crowded in the place where we had to work, especially, it almost looked like a surgical theater because you have everybody crowded around this precious thing held in place by this very specialized thing, almost like an operating table. So you see video being taken, the object in there, all of the lighting, a complete tent being built to try to control climate. We talked about this robot and how we used it to capture shape. When I say robot, you might think that what I mean is something that can move and operate on its own, but really I should describe this device as a positioning device or a sensor that lets you capture the exact location of 3D points without any contact. So the end effector of this sensor is a laser-based probe that without any contact can shine on, say, a page and acquire points that represent exactly the surface of that page. So across the shape of the page, and I'm going to play another movie here to explain this, we were able to use this robot to marry the shape with the photography and get this exact facsimile. The kind of resolution that we were able to get by doing this was to the order of a tenth of a millimeter. So very small variations in the surface geometry of the page were able to be captured using this. The camera that we used gave us digital images that were very high resolution. Phase one back Hasselblad body gave us 40 megapixel maybe resolution. So huge images with very high degree of fidelity. And let me show you some examples of this resolution. Obviously the resolution becomes critical when you want to see detail. So here's the master shot of Venice. If you take a look at that part and I blow it up, you see there are some chaps there fighting over a bell. I don't think they're real, they're metal. But you wouldn't notice that in the big shot. This was precisely what we wanted to get on the manuscript. When we want to blow up the small detail, if you get everything in focus exactly right, then you want, without pixelation, to go ahead and blow that up. Here's the Cobretti and an example of what text would look like if you were to just try to read. Difficult to do because of the blurriness of the lens, and especially the way the lens was radially distorted on the outer edges is where you would get the most distortion, and that's precisely where you'd really like to see what some of the commentary is about. So take a picture of this and blow it up with what we were able to acquire. And you can see that the text just pops, even though this is really about the size of your thumbnail or smaller. I mean, really tiny text. So I'll show you more examples of this. But the three-dimensional augmentation to that two-dimensional high-resolution image just gives you a phenomenal sort of a representation for each of those pages. So this is the technique that we used to acquire that. Laser being swept across the page in a non-contact kind of way, and the probe would then paint those passes into a three-dimensional model. And it turns out that the surface of these texts were, you can see the laser stripe right there, were really the perfect material for this device to be able to acquire a very, very nice high-dimensional sort of a representation. Well, you might be thinking, okay, so how long did all of this take? Well, we were thinking that, especially after the first week of just getting set up, because we knew we had 772 folios to do, and we knew that at the start we were only doing 50 per day, so we were starting to wonder, you know, how many days we would actually have to suffer in Venice. We were able to increase the rate to 120 per day after the first week, and we basically blew through about a terabyte of storage with each picture taking up 40 megapixels worth of resolution. So coffee driving us forward through, you know, that kind of work schedule, and when things, when you needed to bump it up a bit, you know, we found some other things to do as well. Let me tell you about one of the challenges that we had about week two, once we got into the mode of working. And this ended up being a problem that we solved to fix something that happened on site that ended up being a real benefit for some other things that we hadn't even thought about before we got on-site working. This image has a fingerprint on it. If you kind of blur your eyes and look back, what happened was that the sensor ended up getting a fingerprint on it during a battery change or something, the camera, and a bunch of pictures were snapped with the noise on the sensor. You say, well, how could it possibly happen? We have all these people looking at the images. We have all this workflow set up. And anyway, we know whose fingerprint it was because it's a fingerprint. We trace it back. But that's not really what we said. What we said was, okay, we have to reshoot these. Let's figure out how to do that. Let's get back on time. And that's what happened. But it left us with the following problem. We were working in lockstep where we would photograph a page, and then we would take the exact shape of the page with the robot, and then we could marry those two things so that they were perfect. If you shoot the page and you don't do the shape sort of changes a little every time. The orientation changes, right? So when we reshot all of the pictures with the clean sensor, we had all of the shape images out of alignment. So the question is, what do you do to solve that? We didn't really have time to go back and redo all of the things because we were on a schedule that meant we had to just keep moving forward. So here's the dirty image, if you will, with fingerprint. On the right, we have the reshoot, and it's clean. And this one is the one that's going to match the shape, and that one's not. So what we ended up doing, and this was where Ryan basically pioneered, if you take the difference image between the two, you see that they don't line up, but that the features you're really interested in lining up are all embedded in the text itself. So if there would be a way that you could make every character in one image match exactly on every character in the other image, you could conceivably develop a mathematical transformation that aligns one onto the other. Okay, so you imagine this chain of transformations. I have the dirty image perfectly mapped on top of the depth, and then I have the clean image with letters that match onto the letters of the dirty image. So I should be able to get the clean image to map on top of the depth if you do that chain of transformations. And so here's a graphical representation of making that match work. And then here's the difference image after you've done the alignment and you take the difference between the two. What happens is because the text exactly lines up, it disappears in the difference image, and all you see is that, yeah, there was a fingerprint. And you know whose it is. But we're not going to talk about that. So here's a little rendition. And I know this projector is a little dim, but I will fade from one to the other, and you can sort of see the fingerprint go away. And the text looks like it's just rock solid. So that was one way that we were able to, that was the way we were able to overcome this. But what this ended up giving us was a way to align not just the fingerprint and the non-fingerprint images, but what about the Comparetti? And that was what we ended up thinking about. Could we take a look at an apples to apples, what does the Comparetti look like versus what we just photographed? And could we use the same method to do the alignment? And we were somewhat successful in doing that, and it revealed some really interesting things. So I'll show you some results from that in a minute. So not only did we clean up the fingerprints, but we were able to do some other things. A second thing we were able to do was some digital flattening. And this was one of the reasons that I was strongly interested in trying to capture the 3D. Here's an off-axis oblique view of the shape image of this page. And now we're going to run a flattening simulation where you see the page be pushed down in simulation to a flat surface. And this is sort of a closer view of that process, and you see the text kind of becoming flat it's the kind of thing that you're able to do if you have this representation text from the camera on top of 3D shape.
What's if you have an embossing?
Well, embossing is going to be represented in the camera's view. And depending on how the shape ends up coming out, it will still be mapped into the right place. Now, you might need to model certain things that shouldn't be compressed, right, with separate constraints, which our physical constraints can manage that. It doesn't have to all be homogeneous. So let me show you a couple of examples of this with a real viewer. Okay, so this is a page that I can manipulate in 3D. And what I'm going to do is pull your view so that you can sort of see that at the top of the page you have a really nice non-flat part that causes the text to rise up and down over those ridges. Can you see that? Yeah. Okay, and then we'll just do the wrinkling of the flattening simulation to push that down. So you see it all line up because it doesn't run up and down over the hills anymore. We're simulating the way the material would sort of rigidly, with a little bit of flex, behave if it were correctly modeled. And basically this kind of a representational tool is a great way to look at the way page actually looks, wrinkled, and then what you can do with it if you would like to play around with the simulations. If I get close enough in the simulator for you to see the non-linearity, you can see the text kind of float as it gets pushed. As it settles in, it's kind of an iterative simulation. So this was one thing that we really wanted to be able to do. So now we can go ahead through all 700 and however many folios and represent an image that is digitally flattened versus photography, which has the artifacts from it not being flat, and we can compare them together without any problem of messing with the original. No need to flat that out. Okay. Let me talk about some surprises or discoveries. So color was a discovery. Here's what Copperetti looked like. Here's what our photographs look like. In particular, if you blow these up, you see the saints being eaten and so forth, some of these medieval illustrations that were added. In particular, on this example, take a look at the red text here, which surprised scholars because they hadn't. There's no way that you can know that that is in a different ink. Okay, so suddenly, boom, that pops, and people get really excited, myself included, although I have no idea what that says. But here's an example of one of the illustrations, resolution problems, right, as well as simply no color. And if I give you the colored version, yeah, it's just beautiful, and the resolution's there, too. So you see the actual marks of sort of ruddy cheeks and, you know, gold and red. I mean, it's beautiful. So that was one discovery. Another was an artifact of the alignment we did for the fingerprint problem. This is a page from Copperetti, and that's a page from our scan, and you can see right off, straight off, that there's been deterioration in the last 100 years. So kind of come to this registration problem as being really a central problem. Okay, so things have been digitized either, you know, with analog photography or now in the digital age with digital imagery for a long time, and you have all of these facsimiles. Wouldn't it be nice to pin them all down into a common frame so you can do the apples to apples comparison so that you can put them right over the top of each other or side by side and see what's happening over time, what's disappearing, what's appearing, what's going on. So in this case, you can see that the Copperetti had actually more information here than there, and that evaporated in the vault over the last 100 years. Okay, one last surprise had to do with some scholarship from a comment. And this is where it's interesting that this is actually a text, not just, you know, a fossil or dinosaur bone or something that doesn't contain what I call higher level information, because you read these comments that, you know, occur as the scholars processed and managed this manuscript over the many years. And you see that although some of the comments were evaporating, the resolution we were able to get pulled out new things that folks interested in the scolia could imagine or resolve. In this case, we were able to photograph this part in ultraviolet and bingo, another reason for doing the registration, because now you get the ultraviolet highlights put exactly in the right place so that that text pops out. And this is actually discussing the author's choice of the word to use for carrying or spiriting a body. Would it be the word for an inanimate object, carrying an inanimate object, or carrying an animated object? That body once was animated, now is not. So it seems you would have the choice as the author to pick. And this is the kind of thing that scholars, you know, can debate and is largely lost when these things disappear in the manuscript. So certainly a number of surprises coming out of being able to digitize this manuscript. Let me make one more comment about it, and then I'll move to the broader part of the talk, and that is the leaders of this project negotiated an open source agreement with the Marchena Library. So all of these images in their highest resolution are available to you today for free on the internet. So you can do this talk. Well, except for the flattening stuff. But you can get that from us too, because all of our stuff is also open source. And so I'm really passionate about that, because the holy grail for me includes the idea of open scholarship. I mean, if we can't have some open scholarship, then things break down. So thanks to Chris Blackwell and Ross Scaife, who had the vision that was absolutely imperative. And I think it was one of the reasons why it took so long to get the negotiations done. But they convinced the Marchena, and so now all of this data is openly and publicly available. Well, in terms of the Holy Grail, obviously doing the next Homeric manuscript, possibly in Spain, you know, which is another impossibly beautiful place, except for if you go at the wrong time at the wrong place. There is a monastery outside of Madrid that has another fairly complete copy that we're interested in seeing if we can bring into the canon, building what's called the Homer multi-text, and that would be a indexed, cross-listed, consolidated version that gives you, you know, all of these things together in a common frame. So that's not really the Holy Grail, though. The Holy Grail is this virtual unwrapping idea. So when you can open a manuscript, even if the pages are wrinkled, if you can take a clear photograph of the page, that's great, and it's interesting, but there are a lot of things that you can't open up. Okay, so opacity is not your friend, because when things are opaque and they can't be physically opened, how can you see what's in there? This is a picture of a virtual rolled-up text that was scanned with X-ray. And once we get a digital model, even though it can't be physically opened, it's possible to virtually manage it. And so I want you to get the connection of that idea to the flattening idea. Flattening is kind of a one-dimensional, take a model that just has wrinkles like a landscape and push it flat. Now imagine this is actually a piece of newspaper crumpled up or something rolled up. Can you broaden the model to do a more detailed dimensional opening? And the answer is yes, and the application would be driven by something like the materials from Herculaneum. This is what piqued my interest in the general unwrapping problem. In AD 79, this library was covered up by the Vesuvius explosion and was rediscovered in the 18th century, and many of the materials were opened up. But there were a few that were not, because they're too badly damaged. And if you look out on the bulletin board where I was reading the articles that you have put up, they are digging again. And so there is the potential that other manuscripts could be discovered from that very Herculaneum library. It may not be such a long shot. This is what the volcano looks like from Google Earth. And this is what it looks like from the balcony of the director's office at the Biblioteca Nazionale in Naples. They have most of the collections. There are a few scattered pieces in other places with many, many tales about how that happened. But see how much of the cone left? You know, I mean, And it's all on top of Herculaneum, right? So the very destruction of that library preserved some of those manuscripts are the oldest record we have because they were preserved through the pyroclastic flow. So most people are interested in the you know, the humanity or the you know, the various archaeology, and there were even mosaics and bronze statues that were discovered there. But what I'm interested in is the library itself, and in particular the texts. So this is what one of them looks like. This one was not opened; it's a whole roll, and the reason is that it got kind of crinkled. And if they get crinkled, it's really impossible to try to get the layers off. This one's bent. You see the end-on view, and then it kind of goes like this, like a banana boat. When you do open them, and there probably are conservators here who have or could work on something like this, but you could spend your life doing this and still not make it come out right because it's just so friable. This is what they generally look like. Text being really clearly still there, but the layer is just impossible to really open. This isn't the only set of friable, opaque manuscripts out there, but it's one that's clearly very intriguing. This is the solution early on to do the unwrapping. You know, paint the outside, painstakingly get a layer off, continue that for the next 30-odd years until you unroll the whole thing. This is the result of that solution. And my solution would be something that would be completely virtual. So that's the vision. I'm going to talk about the challenges. And then I'll show you some results, and we'll see what you think. So the key idea here, I guess, is to take the idea of photographing and getting a 3D model and then pushing that forward to extend the idea of what it means to really digitize a text. Maybe you can digitize a text using completely volumetric sorts of technologies like X-ray or CT scanning or MRI or terahertz computing or other kinds of things. Ultimately, the idea is to see more than what a doctor would see when they apply those technologies, you know, just anatomical structure, but to actually read text, because that's the higher level information that's involved there. So in terms of the vision, you sort of need a framework, and that's what I've been working on, is a complete framework that addresses what all the problems are and kind of identifies, okay, where do we need solutions? And I'll just share that with you, because there are lots of different texts besides just Herculaneum. This is the from the Cotton Collection at the British Library, maintained in its damaged form for everybody to remember, you know, what happened to many of the manuscripts. So most of them were conserved, but this one was maintained. This is a papyrus roll that's at the British Museum. I'd love to be able to scan this. It has never been opened and probably won't, preserved for its form factor. And then, of course, Herculaneum texts as well. If you have a systematic effort then at framing this problem, then you might be able to address all of those different kinds of objects. So the first example, we wrote some text on a canvas roll and rolled it up, went to the hospital and kicked the patient out and put it into the CT scanner. It was in the night, there was no patient there, but this is what the data looked like from this first example. Okay, so this is a movie that's playing the slices of a CT scan as a set of 2D images as you go through the roll from front to back. And you can imagine that cross-section of this canvas rolled up is going to give you exactly the geometry that you're seeing. I think about this geometrically very often. But what's interesting as you look at this cross-section is that you see flashes that appear in white. That's the higher density of the ink. So it's intriguing to see the data this way because you know that there's a signature there of the text, but it's really impossible in this form to read it. Now, this would be the form largely that a radiologist would use to talk about your anatomy, but it's really not an appropriate form to be able to read the text. So imagine taking the flattening and adding another constraint where you actually just let the thing drop according to gravity and completely unroll rather than pushing it to a flat plane. That's what we're doing here with that very surface. We're running it as a simulation so that you can see it. But you imagine developing this surface so that the folds fall out and it completely opens up. Once it opens up, you have a way to take a look side by side with the original, even though it was originally rolled up, so you can read the text. So you should be able to make out some faint symbols here, and if I do a little image processing, you can see a little bit more. The densities vary based on the ink that we used. This was the first experiment. So we were encouraged, and recognized immediately the virtues of being able to do this kind of thing because, and I particularly want to talk about dissemination, the minute you get a representation that has everything you want, you've broken the constraint that limits access. Because you've liberated the thing into the digital world and many, many people can collaborate and can talk about it. So in terms of dissemination, being able to do something like this is huge, even if it takes a lot of post-processing to be able to see what you want, manipulate, and discuss. And it breaks a logjam when you have conservation on one hand, controlling access, and scholars on the other, you know, wanting to produce scholarship. Because now you have a liberating technology that breaks that in two and satisfies both requirements, essentially. But it wouldn't be right to talk about the virtues without the challenges. The minute you want to run like a deer, there will be wolves waiting to bring you down. And these are some of the problems that have to be solved in terms of making this work. The resolution of the scanner that I showed you from the medical technology is not high enough to really read meaningful texts. So resolution's a problem. The ink I used was ink I made to make sure that the experiment would work. I'm no dummy, I'm going to write with something that's going to show up in the x-ray machine, right, so that I can get a result. But the ink that you get in the ancient document is the ink that they used. It's not the ink that you want, right? So segmenting it with x-ray becomes a problem. Data sizes are huge, and access to objects becomes the critical factor, because you have to convince people that you can take their thing, put it in a cooker that has lead all over, and leave it there for a while where they can't see it. And making that case is not always possible or, you know, even readily available, so it takes time. This framework then can be broken into the following pieces. The digitization is the part where you try to acquire a representation that has everything in it, volumetrically, non-invasively, so that you can actually eventually read the text. That's not the end of the problem, because if everything is all wrinkled or rolled up, that representation will still have the problem that you have to be able to unwrap or process things into the right form. We call that segmentation and then unwrapping, two following problems. And the segmentation and the unwrapping ends up being about as interesting and perhaps difficult as the early digitization. So I won't, because of time, I won't spend a lot of time talking about the digitization part, although we've worked on it. There are technologies available. We haven't fully discovered or mined the ways we can appropriate them for this purpose. Most of the work has been done with these technologies for either human sorts of applications or for manufacturing kinds of applications, finding cracks in manufacturing processes, you know, that kind of thing. So I think there is a huge opportunity here to push some of these technologies forward in the realm of kinds of scholarship we're talking about. Micro-CT is one place where it's really at because it solves some of the resolution problems. You're able with micro-CT right now to have resolutions down to the 10-20 micron level. So 100 microns is 1/10 of a millimeter. Most of the papyrus that we've looked at is 2 to 300 microns thick. So if you can scan at 30 microns and it's 300 microns thick, you get 10 samples through the thickness of one sheet. So that gives you pretty good resolution even if it's written on both sides. So the resolution with micro-CT really can be there if you can figure out how to handle things. So we've spent some time building some custom equipment, and the reason is that there are issues in applying this to these kinds of materials that aren't solved as a black box from something you can just buy. So I think there are opportunities there. And let me say something about the inks then that would be responding to the kinds of x-ray technologies we would we would use. Iron gall is great because x-rays get absorbed by iron very readily and it causes a very nice signal so that you can discriminate the iron gall ink from the vellum that it's written on, for example. Carbon-based inks are not great because carbon on carbon, right, doesn't give you much way to distinguish where the ink is. But fortunately, many impurities were introduced into the ink that weren't into the substrate. So imagine the Herculaneum material, if sort of a gum arabic carbon-based ink, there may be a signature of elements that makes it different from the underlying substrate, and it may be possible to use that to solve the problem of the radio density variations between those two. I really want to get to the results so you can just see what some of our results look like. So suffice it to say that there's a fair amount of work software-wise in taking a scan and then figuring out, okay, exactly where is the ink going to be, and then how do we unwrap it. And what we've done is spent time working on software to solve that problem, hopefully to the point where someone who is not a computer scientist and not a programmer could still use the software to make a meaningful result from a scan. That's sort of where we want to go, and then we want to make that open source. What's crucial in that software is that positioning in this data be correct. If you estimate that the surface is where the line is in this picture, then you're going to get a letter form that looks like that. If you estimate to the other side of that trajectory, then the letter looks like that. But if you hit it right in the middle, then you get a letter form that is sort of the purest based on where the data is. So you can imagine a tool helping you optimize that if you're looking at a text that you've scanned, you know, being very, very important. Okay, the flattening was the precursor, and so that's why I started with that. And we did a lot of work in the lab before we did real objects with digital flattening to show that we could sort of simulate real flattening followed by photography. So we have papers on that if you're interested in more details. And we first applied the flattening before the Venetice to part of the cotton collection at the British Library. And so that was the first application of doing this flattening. You can see this is another set of parchment pages that have the cockling, and you can see that in practice, the left is unflattened, straight photography. The right, that nice scripting line that becomes linear, even though we have no notion that that should be a line, because once you flatten the page, it takes out all of the distortion from the thing having been photographed when it was not flat. So these examples with skewed views show, in that case, the flattening that we did. And this was what gave us the opportunity to apply the same thing to the Venetus A. And so there's a technical framework underneath for doing this, which I will skip over, other than to say it's based on particles that are connected by springs. So it's a Newtonian physics sort of a simulation that says, okay, if we have a bunch of particles and they're connected, we can model the way a material should evolve under forces that you apply. And so that's basically how, and this is similar to what computer graphics algorithms do when they model the way flags wave or the way clothing looks in the movies that are being made now. We just use it in reverse. Right? So it's a physically based simulation. All right, let me show you some results, and I'll just go ahead and finish at the hour boundary, and then we'll have a little time for questions. Here's another scan of a real papyrus. It's rolled up, and you can see all kinds of crazy density variations, very strong. That's because this thing was sort of gilded. It was from a novelty shop. Just bought it, rolled it up, made a great example. So this is kind of what it looked like. Yes. So anybody who's been anywhere near, you know you can buy these on the street. Well, so we bought one and tried it. Here's the strip across that we scanned, and I picked a region of interest to just blow up and then show you the x-ray on top of that. And this was with the high-resolution x-ray. So you can see that we got pretty good morphology in terms of the densities, and the strip going across that we unwrapped lined up perfectly. Even though there's no text, it's all just shape, but it lined up perfectly with what we were looking for. Second example was a piece of papyrus that I embedded in a, I think I have the sample here, if I can dig it out, yeah, that I embedded in a piece of polyurethane as a prop. There's a picture of it there. And this is where the title slide shot comes from, the recovered surface from this example. Everybody asks me at this point if it's necessary to take their sample and embed it in polyurethane. But of course, no, that's not the point. That was just so that we could have a nice looking prop to pass around and to illustrate the fact that it's completely inaccessible, right? Here's the data from it, and you see the circle grow and then shrink. That's the slicing going through from front to back. So you get the natural geometry of that sphere intersecting with that that slice plane. And if I play that again, you'll see the papyrus at an odd shape in sight, and you'll see the ink showing up again. And again, this is a constructed proxy so that we could work on all of the pieces of the framework without having to solve the problem of, you know, access in a real museum, portable devices that can be deployed in Venice, you know, stuff like that. So let me show you a simulation of this being unwrapped in its partial state. Since this is all 3D, we can just stop the simulation at any point and just do a fly through. So you can just see the sort of arbitrary shape that came just from the scan and the partial state of unwrapping that it's in. And then if you completely unwrap it, you get a great signal, even though it was wrapped 3 or 4 or 5 times. And this is the photography that we did before we embedded it to do kind of close the loop on the experiment. Okay, so that's all well and good, and I'm happy to report that today I've done a real experiment on a real object too, because that was what we always wanted to do to make progress. The University of Michigan's library and museum has a fair amount of papyrus, and with Richard Janko's help, who was at the time the chair of the classics department at the University of Michigan, we were able to get a really interesting fragment. Now, this isn't papyrus, but it was a fragment of the Ecclesiastes manuscript that came from the binding of a book, and the top layer was clearly Hebrew and was placed in the second chapter of Ecclesiastes, but it was unknown as to what the other layers might contain. So it seemed to be a great piece that we could experiment on. So one thing that was great about working with Richard was that we were able to transfer this piece to our lab, okay? So that removes some constraints. The other thing was that, you know, this was so suitable, he helped pick it out so that it was so suitable for being able to close the loop. What I mean is that he engaged the conservators at the library so that once we concluded what we thought we would find, they were going to go ahead and just take it apart so they could confirm it. So, very nice way to close the loop on that experiment. And let me show you what the thing looks like in a video, because we did a lot of photography before we went ahead and scanned it so that we'd have that documented. And so you can see the top layer, two columns. This thing was basically cannibalized to make a book binding, and then somebody discovered that later and took it back out. And it's about the width of a binding and about 6 or 8 inches long. So we put this in our cooker and did some scanning, and this is what the CT data looks like. And I'll show the axial view so that you can see the layers. And you can see the structure of the binding. If you know how bindings are put together, you can see one of the leather pieces run through to sort of tie things together about halfway through. Right there. See it go through? So you get a really interesting notion just from that, you know, of how the thing's put together. But of course, what we're really interested in is the text. And so this is a real object. We didn't get to choose the ink. We didn't get to do anything with this. We just got to scan it. So there was an open question as to whether there's text in there or not. And this is the kind of thing that you get with normal processing when you want to look at it. And the visible layer ended up coming out quite nicely in the X-ray after we positioned everything just right. And that was a nice confirmation that if there were to be text somewhere else, we would have the signal, we would need to be able to see it. So revealing the hidden text, was done after we went ahead and did our reading. So we went up to Michigan with our data analysis already done. And we said, okay, here's what it is. We've already had somebody read it. We think it says this, boom. And our scholar placed it as continuation of the text on the river's side. The conservator went ahead and tore it apart destructively. And this is what we want to avoid. It's why we're trying to do this work, so that it doesn't have to be done. And this is the kind of thing that we were able to achieve. So let me show you this little video, which is a rendition of what the top layer looks like. And then I'm going to show you one slice. We scanned this in pieces so that we could get the resolution. And then as this tips up, you'll see the structure of the different layers. We looked at most of the layers, but only found text on the reverse side of the top one. And that's the text. And it turns out that it's unique. It's not the same text bleeding through, which was what I thought maybe would be the case, but instead it actually was a hidden layer. And this was the uncovered hidden layer from the conservator. And they match up very nicely, and you can see that letter form for letter form. And the scholar was not really able to get a better reading after seeing this. They were able to get the reading. So that kind of confirmed our intuition, and that is, you know, if we can do the scanning to a high enough degree, you don't really need to open the thing. You'll be able to see it. Okay, so that brings us back to the holy grail of, can we do the same thing on these objects? Is there a lost library wing? Will there be more of these things coming out of the ground? So what to do? Well, the best thing to do is enjoy eating, drinking, and working. This is from Ecclesiastes, one of my favorite books. These are clearly God's gifts, and the objects we're talking about are also God's gifts. Incredible that they've survived so long. So, you know, is there a way to wring more out of them? I mean, I would love to see that happen. This is the work I've been doing in that direction, and it's not work that's completely by myself. The team is huge, and I would like to acknowledge them. And especially I'd like to acknowledge Ross Scaife, who was a part of our team, and I know many of you knew him, so, you know, he would be proud on this day, I'm sure. So, and thank you so much for your attention. I'd be glad to answer questions that you have. Yes.
You just mentioned earlier that, well, first the cotton collection, and also that it doesn't pick up carbon ink so well. A lot of the cotton collection is much more severely burned than that. Do you think you'd be able to scan some of the more burned fragments and pick up the iron borings, because most of it seems to be iron borings, through the carbon?
Sure. What's really interesting about the medieval texts and the cotton texts is that the iron gall would show up very well and would be agnostic to the charcoal, to the burning. So I think X-ray would be exactly the right thing to do in those cases. Yeah. Absolutely.
But what about with the illuminations and the pigments?
So you get varying densities based on the composition of the illuminations. And one thing that I think is an interesting direction to explore is changing the power settings of the X-ray that you shoot through, because the various power settings respond differently depending on the composition. And you might actually be able to produce a pseudo-color version of the illuminations by relating the power settings, right, to the output signal. And I don't think that's work that's been done, really, carefully done. So it could be really interesting.
Because Richard Janka has the same problem with his Herculaneum stuff, doesn't he? A burn on burn.
He does, yeah.
And I suppose, do we know, do they have a variety of inks, or is there a more or less standard ink for the, or are we not at that point?
Across the entire
for the Herculaneum collection.
So all I know about are the three fragments I've been able to get from the Sorbonne, mm-hmm. and we've done SEM and some other tests on those fragments. But I can't say anything collection-wide, and I don't know that that's been done.
No. And I remember him
right.
talking about it reading black on black. That
right.
was very much thought about when you were speaking.
Well, for things that have already been opened, they've done work with multispectral imaging.
Yes.
To get better images, and that's been very successful. So you wouldn't want to revisit that for things that are open, but there are still even hidden layers, right, for things
yes.
that have been opened, but you can't peel off, so you have three or four layers stuck together. Mm-hmm. We'd love to be able to apply something like this to get at those hidden layers.
Absolutely.
you probably aren't going to want to continue to ask too many questions when the wine groups are being popular.
Can we do the second two things at the same time?
Okay. How did you manage to convince the librarians in Venice to use laser, sort of intensive, like, laser on their sort of.
I mean, that's a really good question. I really didn't do the convincing. I mean, I was so glad to be a part of a very savvy, powerful team of scholars, and I only did, you know, my part. So I think that the conservators and the classicists who had the relationship, they did the convincing, and I just did the work. So, and that's a pretty good position to be in if you can get someone else to get positions, you know. The laser, though, is very low power and produced much less of an effect than basically doing the ultraviolet shots. So ultraviolet ends up producing a lot more of an impact on the manuscript than a fairly low power laser. So I'm sure that was the argument that would be made. That would be the one that I would make. So.
So how long, how many in just sheer days were you working on the manuscript in Venice?
Overall, the project was 5 weeks, I believe.
That's pretty quick, isn't it?
But I believe the primary manuscript was completed after three and a half.
We did three manuscripts in 5 weeks. We did 2,500 images in 5 weeks.
It really is pretty quick, isn't it?
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. Yeah. Only 3D on the one, though. The other two were just the...
Yeah, we did do macro imaging as well as the UV imaging. As
You said earlier that there's a problem with handling a huge amount of information, terabyte counts. What is actually the problem with handling a huge amount of information in this kind of context?
Well, when you have the X-ray information coming at the resolution of, say, 20 microns, then to be able to get data across something that's, say, the size of the Cotton manuscript that's expanded, you're going to have me. No, please. White, please. You're going to have not a terabyte of data, but you're going to have, you know, gigabytes per section, and then you have to find a way to manage that, edit it, and do that collaboratively. So that ends up being the problem. I mean, you can generate a terabyte really quickly. We did, you know, just on the surface scanning of the other two manuscripts. So it's not like you can just have a PC-based application that just sort of loads it all in. See, that's sort of the problem. You have to be more clever than that. Ultimately, I'm not sure how that's going to be solved. Maybe it'll work itself out through the progress of technology itself. I don't know.
Brent, so the issue of size isn't so much the storage. I mean, storing 1 terabyte of data isn't a big deal, but it's actually processing everything once you have it together.
Yeah, it's a manipulation.
Right.
Because really, the data is unstructured at capture time. It's the structuring of it through the manipulation and software that is really the important part of the problem, and that's where you have trouble with the data sizes.
So is that where you say the bottleneck is, or are there other areas that are particularly slow given the workflows that you use?
For X-ray scanning or?
Well, it's both, not only the scanning, but also managing the data and then putting it into the structure that.
Right.
Where would you say is the biggest bottleneck?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, we haven't done a production system. So far we've gotten away with a fairly small team, you know, working very closely. But I would say, you know, orienting everything and dividing things up and keeping track of all of that is a huge bottleneck. So that you properly conserve the data that you're generating. Workflow-wise.
Your position on open source has been most commendable, but as you move from research into what is really engineering production process, have you a sort of idea of the framework of policy initiatives that we need to put in place so these remain international public goods?
Yeah, I mean, policy questions are important and they're involved. And I'm not sure of the subtleties, right? I just know that we need to move toward a cooperative framework internationally where we could find a way to keep things open. And it's going to take the initiative of some of the important players to make that happen. Otherwise, everyone will always follow the Microsoft model, which is to keep this a little bit more guarded, and that'll be the end of the story. So we're dealing here with things that are well out of copyright. what ends up being the question then is the value add that the scholars are bringing to doing the work. And, you know, I so respect people like Chris Blackwell and the Center for Linux Studies because they're willing to do the work and pay for the work, and yet, you know, release that information to the scholarly community and not try to hold on to that.
There was quite an issue of copyright, though, because when the photographer takes the image, that becomes his image. He owns the copyright. So then we had to make new agreements on the copyright with the Marciana.
Right.
So there are other issues involved.
I'm not trying to imply that it was not complicated or isn't complicated, but yeah. Ultimately, you know, we're scholars and we want to do scholarship. And, you know, if you do all of this work and you generate text, but then people can't use it to do the scholarship, then, you know, you're going to fail.
So you need an MIR scanner, which is not easy to acquire, I suppose, and we have an access to it. And you need a huge processing of computers or clusters of computers. And you, on top of that, you need something to do. I mean, this is really a
My math teacher used to start questions like that and say, so assume that you're Prince Charles. Yeah, I mean, you're right. The bar is high for what I'm talking about. So, but on the other hand, the kinds of images we capture just with the color camera that we use to get, that camera 10 years ago would be the same comment, right? How can I afford the $200,000 that it would take to go to NASA, you know, because they'd be the only one to have that. Well, now it's, you can lease it for a week, and it's affordable. So 10 years from now, you know, if we push the work forward, those computational clusters and those X-ray sources might not be so formidable. But for now, I mean, your point is well taken. I mean, the bar is high.
No, I'm not discouraging or anything. I really sort of see that we're talking a smaller world. I think it's fantastic. And for a lot of sort of these objects, it's the only opportunity to actually see what's actually inside.
I've been a bit overwhelmed by this. Actually, I may well have mentioned this, and I've just gone. The Dead Sea Scrolls, I think there's some people from working on that. I didn't mention the techniques, but it sounds as if they've done very successful work on exactly sort of bottom picture you've been doing. Have you had contact with them?
I have met some of those folks, and in particular, one of the multispectral guys who worked on part of their collection, Greg Pierman from JPL. I met him and talked to him at length about what he did. Typically, they've done multispectral scanning on the parts of the manuscript that are already open. There are very few pieces that the conservators have not revealed, in fact, so most of the collection is open. So the question at that point really is just one of enhancement. How can you enhance what the text looks like through various technologies? Yeah, I am aware of their work, and for the most part, they haven't done any of this kind of work because everything's already open, and so they don't have many hidden layers at all. Of course, that's a fascinating collection, and it is rife with a lot of its own. It's not that easy to just approach people who work with those manuscripts and find out collection-wide information, because many people have only worked on pieces. So I guess I can't really speak for what's been done collection-wide with something so vast, but I am aware of some things.
Could we go back to an image you showed? When you compared the reading, that comparison, I wanted to ask you what is the significance of those two sort of black footmarks on the image? Yeah, that one, yes.
So you get dropouts based on the positioning of the software.
Uh-huh.
because of the variations in the thicknesses. Mm-hmm. And because the variations are so unpredictable, the software basically forces the way you position the surface to have good continuation. So you use a smooth curve, but the surface underneath doesn't necessarily respect smoothness. So what happens here is that the curve goes across a gap and bridges it, and then you end up picking up from the X-ray a place where there really wasn't part of the surface there, and you get these artifacts. So we've since tried to generate helpful tools that can let the user push and pull and move to try to better position things to reveal the text. But it's a really interesting software problem because it's hard to make it fully automatic, and X-ray has its own problems, so we end up with these kinds of things.
So one can imagine, supposing the text had remained, had not been uncovered, you were simply working with the image, which is what you will probably normally be doing. So you won't have the check.
My theory is that something like an unopened Herculaneum roll would actually give you a way better, you know, result than something that was partially open and half destroyed.
I suppose.
You know, because it would be, everything's going to be very regular in the internal structure, right? It's undisturbed.
But what I'm thinking is that when you get your hidden layer and there is some blackout bits like that, you still may be able to reach them. The fact
yes,
that image
right.
one doesn't get there,
right.
you still, you're going to be working on
maybe
until you...
Push and pull and maybe in the
yes.
data. Yeah, exactly.
You're not actually being told the information isn't there.
Right. Oh, another interesting thing about doing these scans and the 3D scanning is that you end up with metric information. That is, you have measurements everywhere.
Yeah.
In a photograph, you don't have that.
Yeah.
So I can tell you exactly how big every little bit of this is. So it can actually be used as a representation to pin all of this stuff together so that you can reference.
Yeah.
Not just a picture of a ruler and an odd image, you know, and that's the best you get. So.
It's really a huge usage would be for this because
yeah.
you can see it in the fabrics you discover and great furniture and things like that. You could actually unfold it. Could, there's this Russian Museum in room 70, there's the crocodile suit, which actually being found on a grave, all squashed, and it took about 6 months to beat it up. You could actually do it
digitally.
Mm-hmm. Digitally. And it's fantastic. It's really fantastic.
Yeah, I do love this idea of digital restoration, I have to mm-hmm. say, you know, and, you know, flattening and unwrapping, and, you know, it's pretty interesting. Thank you so much.
Any other questions? Okay, should we thank Brent one more time?